Chapter 86. The appointed time, it is night in Lincoln's Inn perplexed, and troublous valley of the shadow of the law, where suitors generally find, but little day and fat candles are snuffed out in offices, and clerks have rattled down the crazy wooden stairs and dispersed. The bell that rings at 9 o'clock has ceased its doleful clangor about nothing, the gates are shut, and the night porter, a solemn warder with a mighty power of sleep, keeps guard in his lodge. From tiers of staircase windows clogged lamps like the eyes of equity, bleared Argus with a fathomless pocket for every eye and an eye upon it, dimly blink at the stars. And dirty upper casements, here and there, hazy little patches of candlelight reveal where some wise draftsman and conveyancer yet toils for the entanglement of real estate in meshes of sheepskin, in the average ratio of about a dozen of sheep to an acre of land. Over which bee-like industry these benefactors of their species linger yet, though office hours be past, that they may give, for every day, some good account at last. In the neighboring court, where the Lord Chancellor of the Rag and Bottle Shop dwells, there is a general tendency towards beer and supper. Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins, whose respective sons, engaged with a circle of acquaintance in the game of hide-and-seek, have been lying in ambush about the byways of Chancery Lane for some hours, and scouring the plain of the same thoroughfare to the confusion of passengers. Mrs. Piper and Mrs. Perkins have but now exchanged congratulations on the children being abed, and they still linger on a doorstep over a few parting words. Mr. Crook and his lodger, and the fact of Mr. Crook's being continually in liquor, and the testamentary prospects of the young man are, as usual, the staple of their conversation. But they have something to say, likewise, of the harmonic meeting at the Soul's Arms, where the sound of the piano through the partly opened windows jingles out into the court, and where little Swills, after keeping the lovers of harmony in a roar like a very Yorick, may now be heard taking the gruff line in a concerted piece, and sentimentally adjuring his friends and patrons to listen, 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 to the waterfall. Mrs. Perkins and Mrs. Piper compare opinions on the subject of the young lady of professional celebrity who assists at the harmonic meetings, and who has a space to herself in the manuscript announcement in the window, Mrs. Perkins possessing information that she has been married a year and a half, though announced as Miss M. Mulvillison, the noted siren, and that her baby is clandestinely conveyed to the Soul's Arms every night, to receive its natural nourishment during the entertainments. Sooner than which, myself, says Mrs. Perkins, I would get my living by selling lucifers. Mrs. Piper, as in duty bound, is of the same opinion, holding that a private station is better than public applause, and thanking heaven for her own and, by implication, Mrs. Perkins' respectability. By this time the potboy of the Soul's Arms appearing with her supper pint well frothed, Mrs. Piper accepts that tankard and retires indoors, first giving a fair good night to Mrs. Perkins, who has had her own pint in her hand ever since it was fetched from the same hostelry by young Perkins, before he was sent to bed. Now there is a sound of putting up shop shutters in the court and a smell, as of the smoking of pipes, and shooting stars are seen in upper windows, further indicating retirement to rest. Now too, the policeman begins to push at doors, to try fastenings, to be suspicious of bundles, and to administer his beat, on the hypothesis that everyone is either robbing or being robbed. It is a close night, though the damp cold is searching too, and there is a laggard mist a little way up in the air. It is a fine steaming night, to turn the slaughterhouses, the unwholesome trades, the sewerage, bad water, and burial grounds to account, and give the registrar of death some extra business. It may be something in the air there is plenty in it, or it may be something in himself that is in fault, but Mr. Weevil, otherwise Jobling, is very ill at ease. He comes and goes between his own room and the open street door 20 times an hour. He has been doing so ever since it fell dark. Since the Chancellor shut up his shop, which he did very early tonight, Mr. Weevil has been down and up, and down and up with a cheap tight velvet skull cap on his head, making his whiskers look out of all proportion, oftener than before. It is no phenomenon that Mr. Snagsby should be ill at ease too, for he always is so, more or less, under the oppressive influence of the secret that is upon him. Impelled by the mystery of which he is a partaker, and yet in which he is not a sharer, Mr. Snagsby haunts what seems to be its fountainhead, the rag and bottle shop in the court. It has an irresistible attraction for him. Even now, coming round by the Soul's Arms with the intention of passing down the court, and out at the Chancery Lane end, and so terminating his unpremeditated after-supper stroll of 10 minutes long from his own door and back again, Mr. Snagsby approaches. "What, Mr. Weevil?" says the stationer, stopping to speak. "Are you there?" "Aye," says Weevil, "here I am, Mr. Snagsby." "Airing yourself, as I am doing, before you go to bed?" the stationer inquires. "Why, there's not much air to be got here, and what there is not very freshening," Weevil answers, glancing up and down the court. "Very true, sir. Don't you observe," says Mr. Snagsby, pausing to sniff and taste the air a little, "don't you observe, Mr. Weevil, that you're not to put too fine a point upon it, that you're rather greasy here, sir? Why, I have noticed myself that there is a queer kind of flavor in the place tonight," Mr. Weevil rejoins. "I suppose it's chops at the Soul's Arms." "Chops, do you think? Oh, chops, eh?" Mr. Snagsby sniffs and tastes again. "Well, sir, I suppose it is. But I should say their cook at the Soul wanted a little looking after. She has been burning them, sir." And I don't think Mr. Snagsby sniffs and tastes again, and then spits and wipes his mouth. "I don't think, not to put too fine a point upon it, that they were quite fresh when they were shown the gridiron." "That's very likely. It's a tainting sort of weather." "It is a tainting sort of weather," says Mr. Snagsby, "and I find it sinking to the spirits. By George, I find it gives me the horrors," returns Mr. Weevil. "Then, you see, you live in a lonesome way, and in a lonesome room, with a black circumstance hanging over it," says Mr. Snagsby, looking in past the other's shoulder along the dark passage, and then falling back a step, to look up at the house. "I couldn't live in that room alone, as you do, sir. I should get so fidgety and worried of an evening, sometimes, that I should be driven to come to the door and stand here sooner than sit there. But then it's very true that you didn't see, in your room, what I saw there. That makes a difference." "I know quite enough about it," returns Tony. "It's not agreeable, is it?" pursues Mr. Snagsby, coughing his cough of mild persuasion behind his hand. "Mr. Crook ought to consider it in the rent. I hope he does, I am sure. I hope he does," says Tony. "But I doubt it." "You find the rent too high, do you, sir?" returns the stationer. "Rents are high about here. I don't know how it is exactly, but the law seems to put things up in price." "Not," adds Mr. Snagsby with his apologetic cough, "that I mean to say a word against the profession I get my living by." Mr. Weevil again glances up and down the court, and then looks at the stationer. Mr. Snagsby, blankly catching his eye, looks upward for a star or so, and coughs a cough expressive of not exactly seeing his way out of this conversation. "It's a curious fact, sir," he observes, slowly rubbing his hands, "that he should have been..." "Who's he?" interrupts Mr. Weevil. "The deceased, you know," says Mr. Snagsby, twitching his head and right eyebrow towards the staircase, and tapping his acquaintance on the button. "Ah, to be sure," returns the other, as if he were not over fond of the subject. "I thought we had done with him. I was only going to say it's a curious fact, sir, that he should have come and lived here, and been one of my writers, and then that you should come and live here, and be one of my writers too. Which there is nothing derogatory, but far from it in the appellation, says Mr. Snagsby, breaking off with a mistrust that he may have unpolitely asserted a kind of proprietorship in Mr. Weevil, because I have known writers that have gone into brewers' houses and done really very respectable indeed. Eminently respectable, sir, adds Mr. Snagsby with a misgiving that he has not improved the matter. It's a curious coincidence, as you say, answers Weevil, once more glancing up and down the court. Seems a fate in it, don't there? Suggests the stationer. There does. Just so, observes the stationer with his confirmatory cough. Quite a fate in it. Quite a fate. Well, Mr. Weevil, I am afraid I must bid you good night. Mr. Snagsby speaks, as if it made him desolate to go, though he has been casting about for any means of escape ever since he stopped to speak. My little woman will be looking for me else. Good night, sir. If Mr. Snagsby hastens home to save his little woman the trouble of looking for him, he might set his mind at rest on that score. His little woman has had her eye upon him round the soul's arms all this time, and now glides after him with a pocket handkerchief wrapped over her head, honoring Mr. Weevil and his doorway with a searching glance as she goes past. You'll know me again, ma'am, at all events, says Mr. Weevil to himself, and I can't compliment you on your appearance, whoever you are, with your head tied up in a bundle. Is this fellow never coming? This fellow approaches as he speaks. Mr. Weevil softly holds up his finger and draws him into the passage and closes the street door. Then they go upstairs, Mr. Weevil heavily and Mr. Guppy, for it is he, very lightly indeed. When they are shut into the back room, they speak low. I thought you had gone to Jericho at least instead of coming here, says Tony. Why, I said about 10.
You said about 10. Tony repeats.
Yes, so you did say about 10. But according to my count, it's 10 times 10, it's 100 o'clock. I never had such a night in my life. What has been the matter?
That's it, says Tony. Nothing has been the matter. But here have I been stewing and fuming in this jolly old crib till I have had the horrors falling on me as thick as hail.
There's a blessed looking candle, says Tony, pointing to the heavily burning taper on his table with a great cabbage head and a long winding sheet.
That's easily improved, Mr. Guppy observes as he takes the snuffers in hand.
Is it? Returns his friend. Not so easily as you think. It has been smoldering like that ever since it was lighted.
Why, what's the matter with you, Tony? Inquires Mr. Guppy, looking at him, snuffers in hand, as he sits down with his elbow on the table.
William Guppy, replies the other, I am in the Downs. It's this unbearably dull, suicidal room and old bogway downstairs, I suppose.
Mr. Weevil moodily pushes the snuffers tray from him with his elbow, leans his head on his hand, puts his feet on the fender, and looks at the fire.
Mr. Guppy, observing him, slightly tosses his head and sits down on the other side of the table in an easy attitude.
Wasn't that Snagsby talking to you, Tony?
Yes, and yes, it was Snagsby, said Mr. Weevil, altering the construction of his sentence.
On business?
No. No business. He was only sauntering by and stopped to prose.
I thought it was Snagsby, says Mr. Guppy, and thought it as well that he shouldn't see me, so I waited till he was gone.
There we go again, William G. Exclamation point, cried Tony, looking up for an instant. So mysterious and secret. By George, if we were going to commit a murder, we couldn't have more mystery about it.
Mr. Guppy affects to smile, and with the view of changing the conversation, looks with an admiration, real or pretended, round the room at the Galaxy Gallery of British Beauty, terminating his survey with the portrait of Lady Dedlock over the mantelshelf, in which she is represented on a terrace, with a pedestal upon the terrace, and a vase upon the pedestal, and her shawl upon the vase, and a prodigious piece of fur upon the shawl, and her arm on the prodigious piece of fur, and a bracelet on her arm.
That's very like Lady Dedlock, says Mr. Guppy. It's a speaking likeness.
I wish it was, growls Tony, without changing his position. I should have some fashionable conversation here then. Finding by this time that his friend is not to be wheedled into a more sociable humor, Mr. Guppy puts about upon the ill-used tack and remonstrates with him. Tony, says he, I can make allowances for lowness of spirits, for no man knows what it is when it does come upon a man better than I do, and no man perhaps has a better right to know it than a man who has an unrequited image imprinted on his ear. But there are bounds to these things, when an unoffending party is in question, and I will acknowledge to you, Tony, that I don't think your manner on the present occasion is hospitable or quite gentlemanly. This is strong language, William Guppy, returns Mr. Weevil. Sir, it may be, retorts Mr. William Guppy, but I feel strongly when I use it. Mr. Weevil admits that he has been wrong, and begs Mr. William Guppy to think no more about it. Mr. William Guppy, however, having got the advantage, cannot quite release it without a little more injured remonstrance. No. Dash it, Tony, says that gentleman, you really ought to be careful how you wound the feelings of a man who has an unrequited. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.